Hey, Chief. Good morning, everyone. I'm calling this meeting to order at 0900 at 9 a.m. This is the second or third official meeting of the AIR Committee. I'm here with my vice chair, Public Defender Kofer. We're just going to go around the room, starting on this side, and we're just going to introduce ourselves and make sure we all know we're here. Go ahead, Ms. Bell.
Sure. I'm Dr. Colleen Bell. I'm the president of the Health Division in Sulzbacher.
If you could just press the button to make sure it's green. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Sorry. I'm Dr. Colleen Bell. I'm the president of the Health Division at Sulzbacher.
Good morning. I am Deborah Wesley. I'm Assistant Chief, Jacksonville Sheriff's Office, over intake processing at the jail.
Good morning. I'm Coral Messina, Assistant State Attorney and Smart Justice Coordinator.
Good morning. Charlie Coe for Public Defender, and I'll apologize to Assistant Chief Wesley. I think I got her roped into this after talking with Director Goff and Chief Restivo, and they said she's the person that y'all need on coming to that committee.
You mean she's fortunate to be here. She's lucky to be here. She loves the being here.
That's what I meant to say.
I mean, it's 9 a.m. on a Friday. Who doesn't want to be in a city hall, you know, meeting? Good morning, everyone. This is Jimmy Peluso. I am the chair of the AIR Committee.
Good morning, Michael Wynn, District 6, and chair of the JSO Facilities Review Committee.
Well, thank you, everyone. We also have Reggie Fullwood. She should be coming in a little bit later today. We have two excused absences today. Chief Pascal and Monet Holder are both excused. At 9:45, we should be getting a few judges calling in, including Honorable Anthony Salem and Honorable Michael Colio. All right. So we did have a tour of the courthouse. We were with the chief judge. It was an incredible tour. It was, about a week and a half ago? Maybe it was a week ago. I don't know. Time has no... Oh, I was gone for 2 weeks. It was like 3 weeks ago. It was a great tour, I would say. Coral was there with us as well for quite a bit of it. And I know I learned far more about the adjudication process than I had ever known before. We do have our meeting notes from last week's or last meeting where we were all together. I hope that everyone can kind of review them, make notes. If before the meeting is over or maybe right afterward, if there's any changes that you think need to be made, we'll just go to Tyler, who's our scribe these days, and we'll just kind of make those adjustments in there. I also want to make it known throughout the future committee meetings to help make sure that we know what recommendations we're going to be bringing up to the full board or committee. Whenever anyone kind of says something, I'll say, is that a recommendation? Is that an official recommendation that we want to put in the, to the full board? Tyler will make note of that. You know, I kind of want to make sure that at our last meeting, you know, whenever we do it, I think December, that we can kind of look over everything from meeting one to the last meeting and say, these are the official recommendations we're going to bring up to the full board, where we as council members are going to kind of go through them. Similarly, if there's any questions that have been offered by any of the panelists up here, I'll probably say, hey, is that a question we want answered by next week? So these are things to make sure that Tyler kind of has that at the ready for all of our committee meetings. Otherwise, I kind of wanted to go through the room. Do we have any sort of major thoughts from our time at the courthouse? I know that you toured it as well, Councilman Borlan. During your initial meeting, I know we didn't have the full idea of where the committees were going to go at the time. Is there anything that you maybe want to kind of bring up from your time going through the tour that you might think that we could better appreciate here?
Well, I think... certainly, I fully expect, as you did, that I was really pretty amazed by the process and the importance of that process staying on time and on cycle as it went through it. And I think that's one thing we need to take into consideration with respect to this process, to say, you know, as we talk about adjacency or not adjacency, how do we handle that? I'm interested in understanding and appreciating the judge's intent of reigniting J1 as an in-person experience or a continued Zoom experience. I think that plays into this process. But beyond that, I guess it was, I'd be interested in hearing those others in the room with respect to that. And then how this integrates with the other committees. Mm-hmm. the other working groups, rather. So it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. But I think yours is critical in many respects to this process of making sure the continuity of adjudication, recidivism, et cetera, is fully explored and developed.
Thank you for those thoughts. I mean, I know that I could, from what I gleaned initially, it seemed like the Zoom process works for J1 for that first appearance, right? As I had heard, I think Ms. Messina brought it up, that in St. John's County they've been doing this for quite some time.
More than 10 years.
Yeah, so more than 10 years. So, like, this is not some sort of, you know, brand new process that came about just because of COVID. You know, rest in peace, COVID. It's just kind of one of those, hey, is this a faster, simpler process, especially for the first appearance. I know that I initially had a little bit of consternation about doing things so much with Zoom, but it seemed like the process was working quite well. You know, my concern is that, you know, maybe there's some sort of potential bias when you kind of like ruffle people through so quickly and you're just kind of seeing their face for a minute, that maybe there's nuances there that you're not going to be able to appreciate. But it seemed like there are other ways to kind of add that into the mix. So that's kind of my initial reaction. I don't really know. I know we don't have the full panel here. Reggie was with us. Monet was with us as well. So I would have loved to have heard their thoughts, and we'll kind of reach out to them later on to kind of get what they think. But I don't know. Is anyone else? I mean, Judge Kofor, you've been in that courthouse for quite some time.
Well, I've been in that courthouse. I presided over, I can't remember how many hundreds of sessions of first appearance court. I think going to the larger perspective, the running of courts generally, I think our experience of COVID.
Okay. Now we got two buttons. I think our experience during COVID in terms of running regular court shows that it just doesn't work very well because you lose the dynamics of resolving cases. First appearance court, it's a little different. I know after we finished COVID, the plan was to go back to having in-person first appearance hearings. I actually went over with Judge Arias, and we looked at the present J1 facility, and because of damage and mold and everything, it just really wasn't suitable. My general feeling is, from my standpoint, having in-person first appearance proceedings is preferable. I'm not sure what the present state of opinion is by the 17 county judges who handle first appearance court. I think many of them, back when the J1 was open and running, liked getting out of the courthouse, going down and handling things in person. From my office's standpoint, it's a much more difficult process because even though we staff first appearance courts, being separate from our clients make our usefulness less effective. We at one point had tried to work on a system where we had two means of communication, where we would set up a separate Zoom system so we could actually have, but it would required having two attorneys, one who was always there actually handling what court was going, and then a separate attorney to communicate to clients. That impacts the number of cases that you can resolve in first appearance court, and I know most of the judges like to resolve cases in first appearance court if they can, because sometimes they will come out a week of taking on those cases with an incredible number of cases they then need to resolve effectively within the next 17 weeks. I can get a polling, I think, of the county judges and their feeling on whether video is the way to go permanently or whether they would like to have the capacity and ability to do them in person.
I think that would be valuable. So that's a next meeting we have. We'll kind of have that poll of yours.
Okay. I'll try to do that. I'll see if they're all meeting anytime. They usually meet once a month or
I will say I was a little, because we sat through a couple, right? It was Judge Sadler who was up there for the first appearance stuff. I was a little surprised that I didn't really hear much from the public defender who was sitting there. I guess I didn't really hear too much from the...
We didn't stay to the point where the misdemeanor cases were being adjudicated.
Right.
I think that's when we would have heard more. But it is difficult to, if they're not with their clients.
Yeah, it's difficult to do anything in terms of effective representation without some better communication with the clients, and that's just difficult to do.
In Clay and Nassau, they've been doing it a Zoom type model since well before COVID. The defense lawyer is in the jail with the defendant, and it's the judge and the state attorney who is remote.
Is that just a major impediment because of lack of staffing, or?
Well, yeah. Okay. One, that's, you know, I don't have the ability to put right now two people, one at the jail and one with the courts. It gets into complex issues about not having someone with the judge and the state physically. It's a delicate, I'm not sure how I best explain what those issues are.
Well, hey, you got the floor.
Well, the issue and the risk is that if we aren't present, then it inhibits discussion between the courts and the state and the dynamics there. So it's called ex-parting, and so it just makes it open to defendants being ex-parted. And I'm trying not to cast aspersions on either the state or the courts, but it's a rich environment for being ex-parted.
So I guess my question is, so how do the other counties, I guess, avoid that, or do they not? Like, is that?
So in Nassau, the court and the prosecutor were not even in the same room. They were both using remote from their own locations.
Sure.
So it was harder to do that. But if the judge and the prosecutor were in the same room remote, I think I agree with Judge Kofer. That would be a little, could make some defendants feel left out of the conversation.
Okay. So this is not the whole purpose of this committee, right, of course, but I'm just asking for my own edification. So if there were, when people were in separate rooms, does that make it easier? I mean, I don't.
It would, but, you know, the problem is solved if the county judges feel like returning to everybody being in one place, mm-hmm, in the jail. I can try to pull them. I'm not sure if I'll be able to before the next meeting.
And before I recognize the councilman, I just want to say that I had heard that there was a potential safety issue as well that was now mitigated more because of the Zoom environment. And that's what, so to me, that kind of made a lot of sense. I heard there was a lot more, quote unquote, drama in the room when kind of everyone was in person and they're, so this kind of, the Zoom model kind of avoids some of that, especially with so many individuals, hundreds in some cases at one time for the first appearances. So that, to me, that's one of the first things that got me thinking, okay, well, if it's safer and we can kind of move things through in an orderly manner, then that's not so bad. And then I'll...
Yeah, I agree it's safer. There were modifications to J1 when there was one incident many years ago. You can design safety into that situation a little bit better than what we had. The criminal justice system in and of itself is a very impersonal process. And having things done through video, in my view, increases the in-person,
Frankly, that was my initial concern as well.
Yeah.
Councilman Boylan?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I just wanted, through the chair, to Judge Kofer, the opportunity to connect with those people in first appearance courts, on the part of the public defender and or an attorney, did COVID or otherwise, or Zoom or otherwise, did the existing facilities support the opportunity for that interaction between those who being adjudicated and those representing them.
It wasn't the best of circumstances, but yeah, it facilitated it. And even as a judge, I find it difficult. I would have found it more difficult to try to assess and interact with a particular defendant or litigants through video,
right,
versus being in person.
My concern or the question I'm trying to raise here is that interaction between the attorneys, the public defender, and the person who's being charged. I want to make certain that we address that as part of this process as well. I mean, that's actually the step ahead of Zoom, if you will, but Zoom comes into play there. Because my sense in touring the detention center was, the pretrial detention center, was the fact that there wasn't much opportunity for interaction between the defendants and those representing them.
First appearance court, under the best of circumstances, is kind of a rough and tumble process, depending upon the number of people coming through. The video situation makes communication with clients almost impossible.
Right.
It's not great, even when everything's done in person, but you do have that opportunity. It's a sort of thing where judges would go through the general calendar and pass cases toward the end of the calendar, might take a 5 or 10 minute recess, then the PD has the opportunity to sit and talk with individuals about how they wanted to go about their handling their case. And so you do have those opportunities.
But if there's an opportunity where the PD could be in J1 in the current jail with them right now, and then the judge is in a different room Zooming and the state attorney's in a different room Zooming, does that solve this problem? Does that fix everything? Or do you always want a PD in the same room as a state attorney?
I think the process is enhanced when everybody's together, just as our regular courts are enhanced. You lose the dynamics of resolving cases through the video processing of cases. And I can show you the statistics on felonies, how much COVID affected the number of pending cases. The ability to resolve cases just... It's incredible. It's very documentable.
And I can only assume that the goal is to adjudicate as many cases as possible in first appearance, correct?
Well, on the misdemeanor side, yes.
Yes.
That is, I know, the court's goals. It's not always necessarily our goal.
Okay.
But a lot of cases do get resolved in first appearance court on the misdemeanor side. You can't
do that
resolve
felonies.
Is it, please, please.
Well, and I think one thing that is missed when you're not in person is for those defendants that are arrested that have mental health issues or may have some physical disabilities, it's not quite so obvious when you're looking at them in a box, but if you're present and you can see some concerns that the court might want to take into consideration when determining what bond is set or if there's some negotiated disposition that might be offered, those are things that you'd want to...
That's great.
It's stuff you miss.
Yeah. Is it possible to have the state attorney's office and the PD in J1 while the judge is still Zooming?
That's possible, but then you have witnesses who show up for first appearance court, victims. There are a lot of dynamics going on that work when everybody's in the same and a lot of those good dynamics that are lost when things are done through video.
And inmates have other needs for court appearances that could be addressed if there was a courtroom at the jail, like they have dependency issues or family law matters and stuff that they're not going to be released from jail to address, so it's a possibility.
Yeah. I think it would be important for this subcommittee to be able to kind of come together and figure out what we believe the best case scenario would be for our first appearance before we give it to the full body. I know we're in meeting number 2, but hopefully by the end of all of our meetings and one of our recommendations, we could say, in an ideal world, this is how we would like the first appearance to kind of look like.
Well, if I may intersect, unfortunately or fortunately, our role isn't to make a determination of the process.
Certainly.
So it's really up to the public defender, the state attorney's office, and the judges to dictate to us what they, their preference are and what kind of facility do we need to create or build to facilitate that. So I wouldn't, I think it's, I'd be a little nervous about making process recommendations out of this case.
It wasn't meant for that purposes. It was meant for the purpose of the facility that we may build.
Correct.
We want to make sure that facility has certain capabilities and certain room for the amount of people that, that would accommodate this potential method. That's all I meant by that.
Okay.
Because you're right. I'm not here to tell chief judge, public defender, state attorney, anyone in the court system what to do.
Right.
Sorry, go ahead, Cole.
Well, you could also, I think you could also come up with some sort of hybrid system where felony first appearance was handled remote and misdemeanor first appearance was handled in person, perhaps.
I mean, if there are jails
predetermined. That addresses the safety concerns.
But the point being is that, you know, as we look to see what other jails look like, pre-detention centers look like throughout the state, if there are if we're seeing that that's where other counties are going with that, hey, we break them up into different first appearance courts or whatever else, that's something worth, I think, discussing. That makes sense to me, right? I just want to make sure that we're not, I don't want us to get to the full body and we're talking about facilities and nobody brings this up. Because to me, this seemed like a very massive piece to this giant puzzle that we need to make sure we solve. And I want to make sure we at least have, you know, a good indicator of what this body was thinking. Go ahead.
May I ask a question of Chief Wesley?
You may ask a question of Chief Wesley.
So I was just curious from a jail management and classification standpoint, is there any issue with mixing people that are charged with a felony versus people with a charged with a misdemeanor in one room like it is now? Is there any challenges there?
So are you referring to those individuals like being in the same courtroom,
right,
or
first appearance, because you've got a lot of people in one room of varying degrees of risk?
No, ma'am. We just can't house them together.
Okay.
Exciting for y'all.
With that said, unless we have more commentary on how the tour went, I would like to go to Chief Wesley and kind of go into her presentation. Do we have anyone else that kind of has comments? All right. Please, Chief Wesley, the floor is yours.
Okay, well,
thank you for joining us.
Thank you. I was given some specific topics to speak on, so if there's something else you need from me, just let me know.
I was going to ask about the Jaguars offense, how you felt about it.
Not a fan, so I'm sorry.
Well, I'm sorry. What?
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Let me rephrase that. They're not my number one team. I do support the home team.
Thank you.
But they're not my number.
This meeting's uncovered something that I didn't expect.
Okay, so I was asked to describe the intake process, including intake, property booking, and med screening. So to give a quick overview of that, an arrestee enters the intake vestibule. They're told to step to the side, face the wall. They get a pat-down search. They're asked to remove their jewelry or anything that they have in their pockets. Those items are placed to the side so that they can be inventoried, or actually placed in a bag. Then a more thorough search shakedown is done. The individual is then run through our body scanner where, you know, it detects other items that might be concealed in places that weren't discovered during the initial pat-down. Once they go through the scanner, they're then changed out into a uniform. After they change out into the uniform, they're taken over to property, which is where all of their items are inventoried. If they have any cash money on them, the money is placed in a kiosk that's set up back there, and then they get the receipt for their cash. Once they clear property, they're escorted around to our booking area, which is where they first go into our ID section, where they get photographed and they get fingerprinted. Then from ID, they move over to booking. In the booking process is where a lot of specific questions and information is gathered from them. For example, next of kin, emergency contacts. They fill out information pertaining to ICE, PREA. Oh, also in the ID area, when photos are taken, if the individual has any tattoos or anything like that, that's also discovered or taken, photos are taken in the ID section as well. If the individual is a DUI arrest, once they come in through the intake vestibule and they've been searched and scanned, they go immediately to our breath testing area for testing to be done there. If it's a juvenile arrest, they enter in through our sally port. They go to our juvenile processing area, which is where they'll be asked a series of questions and determine if medical evaluation is needed. Once that process is completed, they're transported over to the JAC or UF Health if necessary. If the individual has been emancipated and adjudicated as an adult, then they're processed there and then walk through the process that I just described originally with the adults. They're changed into a uniform, medically screened, booked, kept while being kept separate from all adults.
I do have a quick question.
Sure.
So if you do go to UF Health, are there specific physicians that are specifically working with those that are being booked, or is it just any doctor who's there?
So I don't know all the specifics with that. Okay. I do know we do have a certain area that they're taken to. We do have security there 24/7. But as far as the UF Health piece, I'm not exactly sure what or who they have assigned to attend to our inmates.
And when they're at UF Health, don't they have a guard there?
Yes. Yes.
Does every inmate at the hospital have, is it one-to-one with the guard, or can they guard multiple people?
They guard multiple individuals.
Okay.
So, and then that's another issue, too, that would need to be looked into, because there is an issue with space over there as well.
So if the jail had additional medical facilities, there wouldn't be a need to transport them over there, assign a guard to the hospital, and all of those things?
Yes. So if we had an infirmary in the jail, that is one of the things that I did have in my notes. If there was an infirmary in the jail, that would assist. However, there are certain situations and circumstances when individuals have to go to the hospital anyways and then be brought back.
But at some point, can you tell us what sort of labor is required in order to get an inmate from the jail to the hospital?
Okay.
At some point, if there's enough staff requirements, it seems like it might actually conserve resources to have more stuff handled on site.
So we'd have to have an officer transport over there. There has to be a guard to monitor the inmate. We also, as I said before, we have correctional officers at the hospital around the clock as well.
So just real quick, so within UF Health, there is a specific area that's kind of managed by JSO?
Yes.
Do you know how we can get a quick tour of that, perhaps?
A quick tour of it? You mean you want to go over there and see it?
I want to go there and see it.
Sure, we can set that up. Absolutely.
All right. Maybe that should be something that we discuss after this, and I would appreciate that.
Yes. Yeah, it would be good for you to see.
So you have correctional officers at the hospital who work with hospital security, or?
Yes, we do have officers assigned at the hospital. Okay.
And continue. Sorry that we just kind of jumped in. I apologize.
No problem.
It's good to know what's going on at UF Health.
Okay, so I'm going to get back to booking.
Oh, go ahead.
You have something.
Well, I was just thinking, for some people, if you have to bring them to the hospital, that, I imagine, could present a challenge as well in terms of handcuffing an inmate and if their medical needs and whether or not you have to use an ambulance. So it's not as simple as just put them in the back of the car.
No. Any inmate that's being transported has to be restrained, even if they're in rescue.
Okay.
So even, you know.
And then, of course, if they have some precarious issues, that could make it even more emergent, I guess. Like if they're, we're speculating. Go ahead.
Okay. Let's see. Back to the booking area. Of course, all inmates, male, female, are kept separate. We have holding cells in that area for both. Once they've cleared the booking process, the next thing up is medical screening. Once they see med screening and clear med screening, then they're moved over to booking control. The booking control officer will then assign the inmate the appropriate housing location and supply the inmate with the locator card, a bedroll, and give them instructions to the elevator, and from there they're sent upstairs for housing. So that's pretty much the intake process. That process on a good day with the minimal amount of inmates in processing could take anywhere between 2 to 3 hours. If there is an overflux of inmates coming in, then, of course, it could be more time, a lot more time.
So you mentioned, obviously, an infirmary. How many beds does that typically look like in other counties? Do we know?
Well, from what I've seen and information that I've gotten from some of the other counties that actually have infirmaries, most of the jails were built many, many years ago, mm-hmm. and are now housing more inmates than we thought we'd ever be housing. So they don't have enough. I'll give you an example. I spoke with someone from Broward County. They have an infirmary there, and when they built their facility, they have like 32 beds for their infirmary, and it's not enough now. And they're a pretty big agency.
Yeah. Now, I would imagine, Broward's point, about probably 3 million people or so in that county.
Yeah.
One question about the examination. My experience in touring the jail, the examination area right now certainly does not meet the needs. They're doing some makeshift in terms of doing that, correct?
Yes. Yes, sir. So we're redesigning some things the best way we can now to make that process a little better. For example, we're setting up an area in the actual intake area and have medical staff back there so that they can do an initial screening of the inmate to determine whether or not the inmate can actually be housed. And if there are any issues, the inmate will be turned away and the patrol officer would have to take the inmate to the hospital. So that's going to help us out quite a bit with our process because, as I described before, the current process is they come in through intake, we go through all of this, and then they get to med screening about 6 steps in, and then, oh, wow, no, this person has some serious issues. We can't house them. And now we have to get officer to transport them over to the hospital.
In terms of your you said earlier that's a 2 or 3 hours before they get to the medical examination. Their
Correct.
Situation obviously can deteriorate pretty rapidly during that period of time.
Correct.
The whole intake and booking process, is this kind of done in a lockstep fashion? Everybody goes through each step in the same order, or are they sometimes?
Each step, same order. Yes.
Are there any major bottlenecks? And if so, what would be the A-plus outcome to rectify that?
Right now, the major bottleneck is med screening. Med screening.
Is that space, staff, or both?
Both.
It's both.
Does the initial med screening include the psychological issues? Is that part of the med screening, or are y'all just...
Yeah, so they have certain questions that they ask the individuals, and that does include anything having to do with mental health.
And if you get positives, how long does it take until you get maybe a more of a mental health professional to talk?
So once they have determined in med screening that this individual needs or has mental health needs, we assign them in special housing, and then mental health is supposed to go up and see those individuals within 24 hours.
And do you know right now what the average cost is just to do the booking process?
So there is a surcharge of close.
I meant for like the city. Because I know a long time ago Sheriff Rutherford did some sort of study and was trying to estimate the cost.
You mean like the cost to house an inmate per day or just?
Like the booking process because it's much more elaborate, having to get medical screening and the staff and things like that.
I'm not sure I'm quite understanding your question, but I'll answer it with what I think you're talking about.
Okay.
So each inmate that is processed in the jail, there is a surcharge that every inmate is charged, and it's close to $22 for every inmate, and then it's $2 every day thereafter that they're housed in the facility. Or are you referring to the cost for each staff member that has to deal with the individual through the process?
I think that there was I think they did some study to try to identify what it costs to just book someone, and I think it was closer to $800 to bring them in and screen them and provide them with a bedroll and clothes and all these certain things. And I just wondered if we had any updated figures.
I don't, but I can get that information.
Okay.
Tyler, can you make sure that's listed as a question for next meeting? Also, Tyler, if you don't mind bringing up or putting in the recommendations, I think everyone would agree, infirmary for the actual jail. Size to be discussed later.
Any more specific questions?
Within the present jail clinic, let's say somebody comes down with the flu. You're not going to send them to the hospital, but you isolate them. But do you have beds in your present clinic, and if so, how many?
No, not in the clinic. They would be placed in an isolation cell or a special housing area.
Okay.
Can you explain the special housing area?
Yes, so there may be, say, certain dorms that's designated for, say, for example, like when we were in the midst of the pandemic. Everyone that's housed in there are COVID positive. So it would be something like that. But most cases, if it was like the flu or some other type of airborne, like TB or something like that, then they would go in an isolation cell where it's just that person, an individual cell.
What is the, I don't know if you're the right person to ask, when you are in an isolation cell, what is your day-to-day like? Are you only in that cell the entire 24 hours? Are you out for certain periods to kind of walk around outside,
Yeah, so every inmate that's in the isolation cell, they are, if we're talking about medical purposes, they are allowed to use the phone. And then depending on what the specifics are or restrictions notated by medical, that will determine whether or not they are allowed to come out for fresh air or not. In most cases, they will probably have to be isolated for a certain number of days until they're no longer contagious.
I can tell you, based upon the housing working group, that there are 19 isolation cells.
Okay.
Four on floors 3 through 6, and 3 on floor 2.
And I can tell you currently we do not have enough isolation cells.
On demand. Well, all right, thank you so much. Do we have any more questions for Chief Wesley? All right, we have Reggie Fullwood, who just is here with us. I asked earlier about commentary from folks during our trip to the courthouse. I want to see if you might have any thoughts. And with that said, I actually thought of a new one that I kind of wanted to make sure I have your thoughts on. Councilman Boylan, before you leave, are you sticking around for the whole meeting? Or are you? Okay, cool. All
right. How long it is.
It's only 7 more hours.
Oh, okay.
All right, go ahead, Reggie.
Thanks, Councilman. It was a great tour. I've been in the courthouse numerous times, but I've never had the behind the scenes and the flow of how inmates are detained and flow into the courtrooms. I thought it was a well-run, well-organized facility, so I was very impressed. I think our courthouse gets a lot of flack for being the
expensive,
large, beautiful, expensive edifice it is, but I mean, it flowed well. I think the officers and the clerk's office and everyone looks like just do a great job. It was impressive. Obviously, if we were going to build a new jail, you would want it ideally connected to the courthouse, but that's not the case here. It's just not going to happen for numerous reasons. But I thought it was a well-designed courthouse.
Excellent. Earlier we were kind of talking about you know, for first appearance, we're talking about J1, you know, how it's whether it's impersonal for the first appearance to be solely by Zoom right now. That was kind of the conversation we were having earlier. I don't know if you have specific thoughts on that, if you think there should be more people physically in the J1, if you saw the hybrid model, or I'm sorry, if you saw the Zoom model as a effective method right now. Just kind of thoughts like that, perhaps.
Yeah, I think, you know, I will lean on the judges who, most of them said they would prefer to do court in person, but that first appearance, specifically for light offenders, it seems like the Zoom model is the easiest. I think if it's first appearance and you can close out an issue, if it's a misdemeanor and you can close it out, it seems like you need more time. And having been able to sidebar in person, it makes a lot more sense. But it seems fairly effective, you know. But I would lean on the judges. I think all the judges agreed that in-person court is much better and more efficient than Zoom court. It's what I heard. I thought I heard.
Judge Kofer is putting on a good poker face, but I know he's smiling on the inside by you saying that. But one of the things that I didn't bring it up earlier, so I want to make sure Councilman Boylan hears it. One of the things that we saw and have heard now numerous times is that the paperwork and processing is a nightmare. That there are basically three documents. You know, you've got JSO that has, you know, their paperwork. Then they give it to, what was it, the clerk of courts, where they just basically have to rewrite everything that was written. And then it goes from there to what, the state attorney's office, right? Or to the, there's a third, what's the third one? I'm trying to remember. Goes from,
is that? The judges.
Yeah, to the judges themselves. Yeah, so like, it's just been nothing but stacks of physical paper. You know, God help us if there's a mistake on one of them.
To the identification, there's no common identification even of the people who are being incarcerated in this process. And yes, that did come up in a couple of conversations, and I think that is something you do need to think about in the context of the facility and its ability to do that. It's my understanding, and maybe Assistant Chief can speak to it as well, there is no silver bullet yet created that allows it the kind of flow that we're looking for, but there are some hybrids, if you will, that might make it work, even to the extent of a common identification would be a great place to start, I would think.
I was told there is a silver bullet. It's a very expensive silver bullet.
Well, the IT guy told me there wasn't, so maybe he knew that wasn't reasonable to ask. But seriously, I think that is something we can take a look at. It is the facilities issue and something, an investment the city would have to make in the process.
If I can jump in here, I was actually cornered by Mike Smith, who is the court's IT person, about this. And I think this is a common issue that the sheriff's office, the state attorney's office, my office, and the clerk's office has. And that is, the sheriff's office generates an arrest and booking report, which has all sorts of data fields and information in it. But it's not something that's easily convertible either into the clerk's office system, the state attorney's office system, or our system. And having something that will allow us, instead of having me hiring one person who sits there all day and types stuff physically into our case management system, the state has the same thing. It would be incredibly efficient if we could just do a information and data dump into our system, the state. And I know Mike is very interested in spearheading this because it would reduce errors and inaccuracies in all four of the systems if we could have that capability. It's way beyond my capacity to figure out how to do it, but I know the age of computers is such that it ought to be able to be done.
So. The other thing we haven't touched on with respect to the adjudication process is the time an individual spends from Sally Port to Sally Port and inside the courthouse. It's often 6 to 8 hours that they are. Is that a fair statement to make?
Yes, that is.
So they're in a 4x4 or whatever size cinder block cell for an extended period of time during their wait. Getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning, get ready to go, get transported over at 6:30, 7 o'clock, and then they're there for a good portion of the day. So I know we talk about the efficiency of the system, but it doesn't, it's not very efficient as it relates to those who are going through the process. Is that a fair statement?
It is.
Okay.
That's good commentary. I just want to make sure that it was brought up, mm-hmm. because I know that was, you know, thrown at us quite a bit before we went to the courthouse, and then once we were there and we saw the stacks of paper and how it just needs to follow.
Yeah, in a perfect world, as soon as the police officer puts the person in the system in their car, it should be able to flow all the way through.
Yeah, and I was certain, and now I'm eager to call Mike Smith after this. I was certain that other counties did have a unified model. Ideally, I would assume that the state would want to step in and create a fund or something to make sure that, you know, that the different circuits, was that what it was called?
Yeah.
The different circuits are have the ability to kind of get this funding and kind of figure that out. But I guess because Miami-Dade has their own, right? Broward has their own. Palm Beach has their own. But then we have three counties in one for our circuit, right?
Yeah.
So does that make it additionally more disruptive if JSO has a certain system and our county court system has a certain system?
Well, it's just within a circuit, it would be good to have.
So do we have to get the other two counties on board? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, within each circuit, it would be good to have some uniformity. I threw that back by Mike, and Mike is also involved statewide mm-hmm. in the court system and data systems. He thinks it's probably not presently feasible to have everything consistent statewide. There's so many different systems. But he does think it's feasible to, within the circuit, to have some uniformity. I would even call upon Clay and Nassau clerks' offices and court systems to change. But if it's just Duval County, that would be a help. Because
well, contrast to that, Dade Broward, I mean, criminals do cross county lines. And so... So you could be in three different systems if you are perpetrating crimes in Dade, Broward, and or Palm Beach County.
Yep. Or,
even if we just had something here, it's not just about accuracy of the data. Both in both the PD's office and the state attorney's office, sometimes we're waiting days
right.
to have a case opened. So that means days that we haven't looked at it to determine what charges to file or whether they should be dropped. Or how to, you know, engage with opposing counsel. Then the clerk's office has to assign a division, and then the PD's office can assign, and the state attorney's office can assign the lawyers. It really, I think, the investment in technology to get us on the same page, in the end, would really move all, you know, get people through the jail faster and get cases resolved.
It could be a short-term facility request in the context. I mean, building a new facility is going to take many years. Mm-hmm. Something like this could happen on a shorter timeline.
Certainly. I did ask Mike Smith to kind of give us an estimate of what he ideally thought a unified system could look like. It'll be interesting to see what he says. All right? I mean, look, I don't want these committees to hide away from tough questions, right? Money's going to be a major factor in this. We know that. Go ahead.
I think, Councilman, maybe we should ask the state for a pilot program that, whether it's $5 million or $10 million, ask for, the keyword is always pilot, and so legislators like pilot programs that test, and so we can see if we can create some efficiencies and really sell it to the delegations. And I mean, we know that our state has an abundance of resources these days, so why not ask for it?
If only we had a former state representative around who could maybe lead such efforts
with some juice.
Yeah.
Have two locally that are fairly well positioned.
Certainly. For one, we got a current speaker, and we've got Representative Garrison, who's going to be also a speaker in a couple of years, pending elections. We know how the state is. All that to say, should we move on to our next speaker? Dr. Colleen Bell with Sulzbacher. You are up to present.
Thank you.
And thank you for being here with us today.
Oh, thank you for having me very much. And do I click it forward or?
Is it green?
What green one?
Is your little button is green?
Oh, now. This.
Oh, that. Oh, wow. That all makes sense.
The presentation.
Next slide.
I gotcha.
Okay, sorry. I was like, what? Oh, the clicker's built into this. That's
and we
fancy.
Do have paper copies with us as well if you want to follow along here.
All righty. If you can go to the next slide, please. So I'll try to keep this brief. Just this slide basically says incarceration is big business in the United States and Florida. We are number one. There are a lot of incarcerated individuals. You can see the stats there. The big key, one of the other takeaways, is that 95% of these individuals are going to be coming back to our communities. So we have to, you know, figure out how to reintegrate them. Next slide, please. So the Mental Health Offenders Program, these are two of the architects behind it.
I know that face.
The Honorable Ronald Salem, who's now our City Council President, and then Chief Judge Mark Mahan. Also, the sheriff at the time, Sheriff Mike Williams, was also one of the key supporters for our pilot that we did. Next slide, please. We are loosely based off of the Miami model. Judge Leifman, that's his picture up there, jokes they're a 25-year overnight success. We took a lot of their data, a lot of their best practices, went to visit them, see their operation to help us build our program here, but it's the Jacksonville version of it.
And we can put a pin in it, but I do want to be able to go back to that. Where are the differences between the Jacksonville model and the Miami-Dade model? Because I did hear the judge, I was down in Miami-Dade for an event, and he spoke to us about it, and I immediately texted somebody in the state attorney's office, and I was like, hey, we should do this here.
And
she said,
are.
We do, yeah.
All righty. Yes, next slide, please. This is just some of Miami's numbers that they published. 2,400 individuals are receiving psychotherapeutic medications, costing $636,000 per day. And this is back a few years ago, so I would imagine these numbers would be a bit higher. Individuals from their studies with mental illness are eight times longer and cost seven times more than individuals without mental illness. So it's expensive, and it's really not probably the best way to go about things. And you can see the five-year period, heavy users, cost taxpayers roughly $16 million over a five-year period. Next slide, please. This actually is your slide, Mr. Peluso, about the differences and the comparison between us and Miami. That's their acronym, which I forget what it stands for. The CMHP is the Miami model, and then we're the MHOP model on the right. So that lays it out nicely for you, kind of how our program is and theirs, some of the key differences. Because, again, you know, Miami has a lot of resources. They passed that sales tax on restaurants, which I know we tried to do here, and they have a different approach. So we have to figure out what works for Jacksonville.
It's a tough crowd for that right now, Dr. Bell.
I know. It's okay. It's okay. Well, we're moving forward.
My heart is hurting.
But, yes, next slide, please. This lists all our partners. So this is not just Sulzbacher. I mean, we are a piece, but there are many, many other important pieces. I've worked closely with some of you in this room, including Ms. Messina and David over here, to get David and I were day one of this program, have been working together on it. But really, it is a team effort. It has multiple stakeholders, and it wouldn't work if it was, you know, just Sulzbacher. And you can see all the partners listed there. Next slide, please. Always like to highlight this. This is the team. These are the people that do all the work, as I like to say, and go above and beyond each and every day for our clients in this program. So it's just an amazing, amazing team, and they are the unsung heroes. Next slide, please. This is a structure of our court side, so our court team, and you can see them all listed there. We do have our own Judge Brady, that we've been working with throughout the course of this whole project, you know, as well as representatives from the State Attorney's Office, Public Defender. Next slide, please. This is the pilot. So the City of Jacksonville kindly gave us $200,000, matched by JSO at $200,000 to start our pilot of 20 individuals, where we created a list with JSO, who's also been a key partner of ours, where defendants were flagged in the, I forget the name of the system, CORE, is it?
CMS.
That have a mental health flag, so somebody within the jail has had them referred to mental health, and then they'd also been arrested four more times since 2017 for nonviolent misdemeanor offenses. Next slide, please. This just describes our process, which has changed some in that we get a little bit more leeway now. We have individuals with the misdemeanor crimes do have a bond, a low bond, in order to allow us a little bit more time to screen them. One of the things we found out with this program is somebody from Sulzbacher would come. It was me in the beginning, say, hey, we're going to get you, you know, we're going to put you in housing. We're going to get you treatment. We're going to get you linked up to benefits if you qualify, and all these things. You know, and a lot of the individuals, you know, they don't know us. They don't trust us. They look at me like, well, who are you, lady, you know, to tell me I'm going to get all these things. So we oftentimes have to kind of sell the program, and people are, you know, obviously they've been in and out of the system. They failed in multiple, you know, I like to say we work with the individuals who fall through the cracks of all the systems, you know, and they rightfully so have some reservations about, you know, entering a program. So we do now have a low bond in order to allow us more time so that if somebody tells us no, we go back and we keep trying to talk with them and work with them to try to get them in. Next slide, please. They have a deferred prosecution agreement with the public defender. In the Sulzbacher side, we provide all the treatment, psychiatric, medical. We are a federally qualified healthcare center, so we have a wide range of outpatient services that we can provide to these individuals, as well as the key piece of housing, linking them to benefits and other good things. We follow them. They're seen on average every 2 to 6 weeks by the court. The court is a key partner. But it's a different kind of court. Our court is now done, it has been through Zoom, and that's been working well because a lot of our clients have very severe mental illness, and it's very hard for them to sort of sit in one place. So we have it in an area where they can go out and play basketball, or they can go out and smoke. We have activities. We have lunch. So it's a very different experience, I think, for participants. And then if they graduate, and we do have lovely graduation ceremonies, their case is dismissed as part of the deferred prosecution agreement. This slide just shows our screening tool, and we actually added the two questions. If a client declines MHOP, this is the second iteration of the screening tool, because we did notice we were getting a lot of refusals. About 40% of people were turning us down. We added the questions of help me understand why. And what would it take for you to agree to the program? Here is from our pilot study some basic characteristics. As we all know, persons of color are overrepresented in the criminal justice system. And you can see that here, that 75% of our individuals were in the pilot were African American, as well as some Hispanic and Native American, as well as Caucasian. Not that we planned it this way, but the way it ended up working out with who we were getting to screen, everybody had a diagnosis, and still does, actually, a primary diagnosis of either schizophrenia or schizoaffective disorder. Most did not have benefits, and 90% were homeless.
So 30%, though, seemed that they were getting SSI?
Yes.
Were they getting it regularly? Like, were they cognizant enough to know that they had those funds coming in?
What we actually found in some of those individuals is family was receiving their benefits and not giving those benefits to the individuals.
Yes. The reason I bring that up is I understand a lot of it, not a lot, but I understand some members that are living, they're unhoused, in many cases have the ability to get either Social Security or SSDI, or SSI, and yeah.
It is a tricky process, though, even if you think somebody should be a slam dunk for Social Security. As we all know, the way things work or don't work in our federal government, you know, it can take some time, and we still have to really end up fighting for individuals to get their benefits.
Just add, a lot of this population are also particularly vulnerable, so many of them were victims in very serious cases that we had while also being participants in the program, and so they tend to be taken advantage of. If their mental health needs are not being met.
Yes, thank you. Next slide, please. This is just showing some of our data at the conclusion of the pilot, which I won't go through all of it in the interest of time. If you can go to the next slide, though. This is showing the cost drop. So prior to MHOP, at the 15 that we ended up using the data for the pilot, prior to entering MHOP, that's the blue and the orange. Those are the costs. And then after they enter MHOP, you can see it's under $13,000. So it's really showing a cost savings because, you know, things like the booking costs, stays in jail, transportation to UF Health and evaluation at UF Health under what used to be, what is termed a DN-7, which is sort of a Baker Act directly from jail, but often those were not being used, you know, the person did not meet criteria for an actual Baker Act, so they would get to UF Health, be seen. It would all add the ambulance, you know, the ER visit, et cetera, and then they just be turned right back out. Next slide, please. This just shows some of the surprises we had from the pilot. We thought, based on the list we initially created with JSO, about 60% would have housing because there were addresses listed, but actually, in reality, almost everybody, as I said, 90% are homeless. I already mentioned about the diagnoses. Based on those diagnoses, we can use long-acting injectable antipsychotics, so shots that are given 1 or 3 months, and those are really good for helping individuals achieve stability in terms of their mental health.
Do they, you know, what's the, after getting your first shot, do people definitely come back for the second shot and the third shot?
We tend to have to find individuals a lot and to encourage them to take their medicines, and once they can get some meds in their system, though, a lot of them do see the benefits, but there's a lot of running around and finding people with our clientele.
Can I ask a quick question? I'm
yes.
Very familiar with schizophrenia, but schizoaffective, is that like a combination of other disorders?
It's you have the psychosis, but you also have a predominant mood component, so either depression or bipolar disorder.
Okay, thank you.
And I'm trying to make sure that I properly understand. So is there a housing component to this as well?
Yes, there is definitely a housing component. We put people in short-term temporary housing, i.e. motels, and we even have a unit now at Sulzbacher where we can house 8 individuals. And then we work to if they need assisted living or permanent supportive housing, or if they can do their own apartment, then we help them with those resources. So we leverage the Sulzbacher resources and our partnerships to get them into housing.
Yeah, because that was kind of my concern with the multiple shots. Mm-hmm. You said it's hard to find them. If we have them in the housing that we help provide, I say we, that you guys help provide, you know, shouldn't that be the easy place to find them? Or do people tend to... how long are they in these places, I guess, is what I'm asking.
It depends, because honestly, their mental illness is so severe that it's very hard to achieve consistency.
Mm-hmm.
What we're actually... working on, as you probably know, Sulzbacher is moving out of downtown. We have purchased 17 acres at 95 and Gold Fair, so we have a lot of space if anybody wants to put anything there, i.e. buildings. But we are planning on putting our own mental health assisted living facility, our own outpatient substance use residential, and an expanded area for the MHOP clients. So because what we've recognized, and everybody knows, housing is a crisis, and particularly for these individuals that need a lot of attention and care and somebody, you know, connecting the dots with them. Sorry. It can be hard to find that in the community. There are community resources and partners, but, you know, we're trying to pick the sickest individuals. That is who we are trying to target with this program, the people that really, really need this intensive wraparound support.
And who are chronic offenders.
And they're chronic offenders, yes.
That's why the cost is so high.
Yep. Next slide, please. This is just the 12-month data. Our arrest rate for people in the program dropped 81.2%, and a decrease of 79% of days in jail, as well as you can see the booking cost drops, and then 100% in DN-7s. We've basically gotten away from doing any DN-7s on any of our participants and really reducing the number overall in the jail of that process. Next slide, please. This is, again, just showing cost for 2017 through 2020. The total participant cost, as you can see, it continues to drop. Next slide, please. These are just some numbers. Not going to read these all, but this is 2022. We actually showed a 92% decrease in the monthly average of arrests. I think that's pretty amazing. 87% decrease in days in jail, and 100% drop in those DN7s. And you can see the cost data summarized for 2022 there, and those are our most updated numbers. We were able to expand. Our pilot started with 20 through the generous funding of our managing entity, LSF. We've been able to go to 40 individuals and hire more staff to serve them. We've also broadened our referral base. Judges are now directly referring clients that they think should be screened. And we've also added those who were previously showing up on the DN7 list to our MHOP list. Keep your fingers and toes crossed. There's an extremely large DCF grant out there, a total of $8 million that we are putting in for. If we get that, our plan would be going to 150 individuals and expanding to felonies as well as misdemeanors and state hospital diversions. Peer support, I just wanted to highlight that's a key component to what we do. Next slide, please. Step-down housing, that's a picture of one of the rooms we have over at our Sulzbacher campus. Looks pretty nice, looks like a dorm room. Next slide, please. Just briefly, this is one of our heavy hitter in terms of arrests. You can see 97 arrests since 2017. I think he had 132 lifetime arrests. Basically, he was in jail on average every 10 days. He was sleeping in dumpsters. He would cover himself in feces as a protective measure, so nobody will bother you if you're covered in feces sleeping in a dumpster. Except he would sleep in JSO's dumpster, and they'd arrest him. And anyway, in and out, very, very psychotic. He took all the Sulzbacher resources. It was a team effort to get him stable. We had to monitor him in the bathroom because he'd clog the toilets. I mean, I could go IQ, very low IQ in the 40s, severe schizophrenia. He has not been rearrested. He is living in an assisted living facility. He now has a public guardian, and he is doing much, much better, knock on wood. Next slide, please. That just shows the costs associated with that one individual, how we were able to drop it. Next slide, please. These are all our partners, people that have supported us along the way. I've just highlighted a few. As you probably know, that's a picture of our CEO in the top right-hand corner. And she is amazing. Next slide, please.
Let the record show, Cindy Funkhauser's amazing.
Yes. we take lots of learners. We actually have psychiatry residents that come with us for 6 months at a time, and they love this kind of work. I mean, it's really, we have medical students that come. We have social work students that come. So we're really trying to share this type of work, you know, with the next generation in the workforce. Next slide, please. Fun pictures, and these, you know, it's not fluff. I mean, this is what really matters, because these are individuals who are not welcome or haven't been welcome in society at large. You know, they've been shunned. They're the people you walk across the street to avoid. They're the people that, you know, have the poor hygiene sitting on the corner. And look, they're bowling. We're giving them birthday balloons. You know, we're getting them in housing. We're getting them their hair cut, taking them shopping. So all this stuff matters. Next slide, please. Taking them to the beach, I mean, taking them to the zoo. I mean, this is really, it's really wonderful to see how people blossom, you know, with just a little bit of attention and treating them like they're normal. And then people, they live up to that. We take them out miniature golfing. I mean, it's really been fun. These are some pictures from our last graduation. We've had 4 graduations so far. It's always a wonderful experience. Some of the clients, you know, they will perform songs or rap. So feel free. I will happily invite all of you to the next one. We're currently working on when that will be. Next slide, please. Here's just a few more pictures of some of the clients we've had. And we don't have time, but I included a link to some of our videos, Transformations, which is next Thursday. At the Times Union Center last year, we had a client that was one of our stars, an MHOP client that was one of the stars, so that video link is there, as well as the News for Jax did a nice spot on us. I think it was over the summer that came out, so it's been a really wonderful program. I'm just blessed to be a part of it, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. So I should probably know. Oh, go ahead.
Just a couple. As I mentioned, Dr. Bell, prior to the meeting, she really needs to hook up with Councilmember Johnson because his committee, this is their focus, area of focus. But as it relates to adjudication process, you mentioned Judge Brady's court. Is that what you would characterize as a solutions court, Judge Cofer?
Problem-solving court.
Problem-solving court, mm-hmm. Yeah. Is that the only example of problem-solving court that we have presently?
No. We have a mental health court, drug court, and veterans treatment court in every single county in our circuit. The only thing we're short, a mental health court in Clay County right now.
I would really appreciate, Chair, that we take a look at those problem-solving courts as part of this process, because I think it can help expedite a lot of the work that we're doing in getting people through the system if there are these problem-solving courts available and part of our process.
I would agree.
So, yeah. Your representative, Ijanaka, could help you get a representative.
Great. Excellent. Mm-hmm. She's been incredibly helpful thus far. So my question to you, Dr. Bell, what is the... How much did the city give you this year, if I may ask? Do we know?
I don't want to say the wrong number. President Salem will get mad. Do you know, David? Sorry to divert. How much the city gave us? It's 600,000 total.
We got 200,000 for the city and 400,000 for the sheriff's office.
Right. Okay. So the sheriff's office is still...
That's in the budget for this year. We've moved under the grants. The last CFO worked with the Councilman Salem, Joey, and moved us there.
The first grant came through the Social Justice Committee, mm-hmm. as I recall. Served on mm-hmm. that.
And how many individuals were served this last year?
So we've increased to 40. So last year would have been 20. So we have a little bit over 40 right now. And then we also have about 14 in aftercare because we don't, you know, once they graduate, it's taken the individuals a lot of effort, us a lot of effort. We just don't want to say, well, you're done. So, you know, because of the level of severity of illness, we follow them for as long as we need to.
I would strongly encourage, as you meet with Councilmember Johnson, you talk about what would it take to make this a significant capacity. What is a significant number? I mean, we're not going to do thousands at a time, but certainly how are we able to grow the program sufficiently to make a dent?
Yes. Absolutely.
If I could add this part, this is very important.
Please.
I wouldn't say it because Council President Salem would be upset if we didn't. That our intent is, if we can get additional funding, is we want to move the number up to 60 this year. It does take additional funding, and that Schulzbacher team is currently working on that. And in fact, to answer your question, they did receive a grant to have an in-jail reach coordinator. Mm-hmm. They're going to be able to hire that's going to help to look for additional people that are sitting in jail that may not have been as easily identified at first appearance that are sitting in jail. Mm-hmm. So those are the types we're going to be looking at.
Thank you, David.
And as it relates to intake and adjudication, things like that, high-functioning people can often mask their mental illness. And so if the jail was equipped with additional mental health providers to help identify those with a mental illness, it would help for this program, but also it would help the lawyers on both sides because we're not there right away. And if we know that a defendant is having a mental health crisis, it helps us triage our work. Dr. Bell, we covered some of the booking costs and things like that. I could pose it to you or I could ask David, since mm-hmm. David's a retired JSO corrections chief, but do you know what the booking costs are? Or were?
Yeah, and that's what I was going to tell you. Chief Wesley and I have worked in different areas, and we've together for many years, but sometimes you can't hit every additional spot. And that's why she wasn't as familiar, and plus I've been there a little bit longer, unfortunately. But Sheriff Rutherford worked, but when he was sheriff, I should say, not the congressman, he worked. Thank you, sir. Sheriff Rutherford worked. He was attempting to set up what was basically became the habitual misdemeanor program. And he had looked at what the cost was from arrest through first appearance. Now, that's been 10 to 15 years ago. And that was where it was a great question to ask Chief Wesley. But the real reason is when he did it, there was a reason for him to do it because those costs, to do one of those, it's very costly to get those studies. And there really wasn't a need to update that. But those numbers while needing to be updated are still true. And at the time, basically it cost $850 at that time from arrest to first appearance to have someone in there.
And then, of course, there's additional costs every single day.
Exactly, right. Yeah, that doesn't even take in the housing costs because we already had a component that we did a study for. And luckily with the MOP program, that study was at least 10 years old. But Sheriff Williams, I was able to work with Sheriff Williams, and without going through a whole extensive study of JEA cost and all that, we were able to come up with a different way to calculate the cost per day to get it closer to what it really should be. So that's $111 right now. So
before we had the MHOP program, a lot of this population was having their charges dismissed and they were being sent to a mental health crisis stabilization unit, as Dr. Bell alluded. Does anyone know what, when they're sent to a crisis stabilization unit from the jail, is it JSO or the city that pays for that? And how much is it for us to send them over there? Any of y'all know?
Well, if you send anybody out from the jail for any kind of a treatment, it's going to be covered under the indigent contract that the city has with UF Health. That's why the jail actually had, over the years, built a holding area over at UF Health, and that thing, that's what the councilman was looking at wanting to go and see. But you've got a holding area over there, and so you're going to, like Chief Wesley said, you've got officers there around the clock because that's a state requirement. You have to have a certified person there that works with the security guards who aren't certified. So,
and I can also tell you that we just appropriated $40 million to UF Health for indigent care, in addition to another $20, $25 million in capital improvements.
Hmm. And I would imagine, though, indigent care is more expensive if you have a corrections officer standing next to you.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Well, and that's part of why you have an officer there who's basically supervising the security folks. So it does lessen the cost to the taxpayers, and it still has that security component that's required. You know, but that's where also, and that $40 billion, that's why you need that money, and that's why you have to have those people going over to the hospital. I know you briefly mentioned that, because while minor things can be handled in the jail, and there are some hospital beds on the second floor, what you're going to have, you've got people going over for dialysis. You've got people going over there for pregnancy treatment, because you're not going to have those specialists. Unfortunately, they're not coming to the jail. So you're going to have those folks going over there. That's why it's worked well, let's just say it like that, to work with UF Health, have that holding area over there, and you get all of that done. And those appointments are scheduled through the medical provider at the jail. So it's kind of a smooth process.
So do we know how many individuals who could be identified for this program, who maybe went through the process last year?
The original list that we created with JSO, which again, I think there are lots missing, that original list was 220 names. And then we added on the DN-7s, so I'd want to say it was over 300. But again, I figured out to receive a mental health flag in the jail, you got to look really mental. It's very obvious that there's mental health concerns to get a mental health flag in the jail. What I don't know is that we're hiring now for that in-reach position, if we can do further screenings to identify people to get more of those who may not, like Coral said, present, you know, as ill.
And I'm sorry, who is looking for that position? Sulzbacher is?
Or, yes.
So Sulzbacher will have that position,
yes,
filled, and then put it in, that person will be embedded in the jail?
Yes.
Okay.
I think the potential number, though, is even higher, mm-hmm, in terms of just studying people who are cycling through, mm-hmm, the jail. Wasn't it in the four or six?
It was. What happened is you had to take a few of those folks out, but because there were some that had different names, so I had to cut through and find the JSO numbers, and that way I identified that person one time only. And plus, we did have to exclude certain things. If you were a sex offender, I can't remember the other one, but oh, you're on probation,
DUI.
You're on felony probation, those type things that had to be taken out. We do have a new list, though, and I have several more, as well as what I think I briefly mentioned, but just in case I didn't, one of the new things we're trying to do through J1, and we're working with MHRC representative, and that's who hopefully that this new person that Schulzbacher is going to have will also team with that person somewhat to identify those folks that are being arrested coming in, and they don't have to have all those arrests. And so instead of them starting a cycle, maybe we could prevent that cycle from actually happening. And because that's what happened. That's where I've got so many new names just from that original list, because new folks come in or something happens, and you start going through that cycle. And it's a shame that they have to even have that cycle. But unfortunately, that's what we're dealing with.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question to Dr. Bell. Or David, are we, I know the Miami program has felonies and misdemeanors. Mm-hmm. We're just doing misdemeanors right now. And we talked about, you mentioned the DCF grant. If we got that, mm-hmm. it could expand mm-hmm. the program up to 150 people. Is there a plan, or have we thought about looking at low-level felonies?
Yes, we have, and we've talked about that internally. We haven't fully fleshed out with the legal team because, you know, that's not my area of expertise. I mean, I'll take anybody, you give me, but, you know, they need to be the gatekeepers and say, because they're looking at things from a public safety standpoint. But yes, we have started those conversations, and I have to really, really be talking about it, Coral, if...
We've already taken a few, like a felony criminal mischief, that actually the charge gets reduced to a mm-hmm. misdemeanor criminal mischief, things like that.
I think you could speak better on it, but we do have a regular mental health court that does deal with some of those.
Yes.
Corals, integral part.
Right. And right now, MHOP has screened more people this year than the mental health court. But we have a mental health court in Duval and Nassau. It's based on your residency. That program still works with some people that have some severe mental illness, but typically their housing and other things are a little more stabilized. The people that Dr. Bell works with are the most acute.
Does Sulzbacher serve Nassau County and Clay County?
They can come to our clinics, but... In terms of like our housing resources, since they're so precious few, we focus those on Duval.
But even then, so like, do you work with the Nassau County Jail or any of them? Or
not at this time.
All right, good. I'm not good. Sorry.
It's okay.
I didn't mean to say it like that. I just want to make sure for
sure
for other things that we're working on. One of my questions says here for the CMHP, it says long-acting injectables not required for all. I don't know what that means.
So that program... we do mandate for those in the mental health offenders program that they take medicine to be in our program.
Okay, so these medications. All right, I just want to make sure.
And particularly if it's appropriate for their diagnosis, which so far, like I said, everybody's schizophrenia or schizoaffective, to take those long-acting injectables just so we can, A, it's better treatment-wise for them because it's more consistent, and then B, it's just, you know, like I said, we do have people that tend to go off for a while and we need to go find them, and so we know, okay, they've got meds. You know, they've got some medicine in them. But they didn't require the medication piece like we do.
But when it comes to, so you had just mentioned there's the mental health court, and then there's also the MHOP program, two separate things, right, obviously. But, like, so why did the mental health court do more screenings than MHOP?
No, MHOP did more screenings than mental health court.
I'm sorry, okay, that does make more sense then. Okay, so is there a way to... Is there a goal to get them to have the exact same kind of list, or is it just two different what they're both working towards?
Both programs could use more money, right, and more resources. Right now, mental health court is they're at maximum capacity in Duval. So,
and we're technically at maximum capacity too, but we still take people in because we're trying not to turn off the spigot in the hopes that the money is coming.
What about you, Chief Wesley? You at maximum capacity too?
Of course, and then some.
Mm-hmm. Chief Wesley,
if you build it, they'll fill it.
This, from a jail perspective, this population we're referring
to. That's not the right answer,
are they? From a jail management standpoint, are they more challenging to manage or less? Or
they are definitely more challenging. Okay. Definitely more challenging.
And they often go to the sixth floor, is that?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And some of them are on 24-hour watch, too, aren't they?
That is correct.
I'm sorry, the sixth floor is that, is what is
this? A designated housing area for our mental health population.
So having programs like this helps alleviate the additional stress on the job.
Helps.
Okay. Make note of that, Tyler. Are there any more questions? And do we have people that call in? Do we have Judge Salem?
Naco is okay. With us.
Eve, did you hear us call your name into existence earlier?
She's
still on mute. All right, we'll get with Eve later to kind of to make sure that we're able to go to meet with the other judges or with the mental health court, drug court, veterans court. Was there one more? Another problem?
Mental health offender program.
Okay.
They're all collaborative therapeutic courts.
All right. Other than that, thank you, Dr. Bell. That was fantastic.
Well, and I would mention the veterans court. I've been tracking our veteran arrests since about 21 through the collaboration with JSO. They take the information and upload it into a federal database and scrubs the list. And so every day we get this information, and then I pass it along to our prosecutors to let them know that the person that they're prosecuting is a veteran and they may want to consider them. And it was about 4.3 people a day in Duval County, which is a lot.
Yeah, I would love to hear from folks in all those courts. Maybe we have them for our next meeting.
And Ms. Janelle.
Hey, Eve, how are you?
Great. Sorry about that. Busy morning.
You are fine. We understand completely. No, I was just mentioning, because I saw you up there, that we were hoping to get names of folks that could speak towards the different courts, the different problem. What do we call them?
Problem solving courts. Yes, we can arrange that.
Okay. That'd be great. I should also mention this to the people here with me. We're going to be moving next week's AIR committee meeting. So we do have one scheduled the week after. I unfortunately have a kind of a last minute engagement. I'm going to be up in D.C. So I'm going to be missing. I'm not going to be here by Friday morning. So we still have a meeting scheduled the week after. We'll figure out when we can kind of pencil in when we can do the next meeting. We're trying to get stuff to you, Councilman Boylan, by the end of December. So
great, thank you.
I think right now we're still on schedule. I think we've done a lot of work already. But
well, I think I appreciate the fact. I don't want to rush that schedule. Our target is in mid-January for the committee to come back together again. But I want to make sure that the complexity and intricacy of the work that you're doing is so very important. I don't want to compromise it. We can slide a little bit if necessary beyond that.
Understood. We appreciate that. Flexibility is good. Mm-hmm. Other than that, we're on a discussion of recommendations. I feel like we've been doing that the whole kind of day. Is there anything in particular we want to make sure Tyler notes for our next meeting? Questions that we want to make sure are asked and answered, and or recommendations that this body will bring to the main body?
I wanted to ask, if I may, Chief Wesley, if there was anything else impact, like an A-plus outcome for the intake process beyond an infirmary. Is there anything else that you would add to a wish list?
Yes, a larger sally port. Okay. That would help. And actually, the infirmary wouldn't necessarily be an intake, but to have a larger medical screening area closer to the back door would be a plus. And I did some site visits in some other agencies, and I found that a lot of them have like an open booking area, kind of reminds you of like a hospital waiting room. I think that would be beneficial as well.
Are you going to be meeting
more space?
Certainly. Are you going to be meeting with Councilmember White's committee as well? They're kind of the facilities.
I'm not sure.
Okay.
Councilmember White's actually is a short-term fix. Housing is Councilmember Miller.
Okay,
his
detention. So Councilmember White's is just for the current current building.
Yeah, yeah, whatever we need to do to make it safe and secure.
It's the Band-Aid.
All right. It's a mandate. Mandate, bad day committee.
Excellent, then. Okay.
If I can ask one question, this may be a little bit outside of intake, and I'll express a common complaint that mostly comes from private attorneys about the time it takes once a person's case is resolved to being released from the jail and the overall time. I know a lot of attorneys, if they know there's a warrant out for a client locally, instead of bringing them to our jail, they will take them to Clay County or Nassau County jails because they can process them through those jails more quickly.
Part of it is staffing. We have a judicial process unit with four or five officers, and if someone's out sick, we're short. And then we have to have someone come in earlier in the morning to do all of the processing for the early morning court, which means they get off earlier in the day. So by the time these documents come back from the court to our unit to process them out, half of the unit is already gone home for the day. And then what they don't complete, they leave a list for our releasing unit to pick up and finish the process. So individuals that go to court and that are being released from court, it can take a number of hours before they actually get processed out.
I have always been under the impression, I may be wrong, that you know, if they come back from court, even though they've been through the ID section, that they have to go back through ID to make sure there's not a warrant that's dropped in those
hours.
Yep,
that's done as well, yes.
Is that part of the problem, or is it more staffing at the jail and just...
Well, that's part of the process as well. There's a second clearance that's done to make sure that there aren't any other additional outstanding warrants somewhere else before we allow these individuals to be released.
Chair, I've got a couple of comments. As you know, because of the challenge of sunshine, you and I can't have conversations about how things are going and some recommendations. But I do have a couple, a question specifically as it relates to recidivism. Is that going to be a focus of one of your upcoming meetings?
Very much so. The last 2 to 3 are going to involve recidivism.
And secondly, are you inviting others like HDR and others to come and make presentations as to what facilities that they're presently building that speaks to the intake and adjudication process?
I was excited to see HDR here, and I at first didn't know why. That's something that I would love.
A practice I think you're seeing, most of the working groups are saying, what are other people doing? And Assistant Chief, I think you and others, I know, have made some visits, site visits. I'm hopeful that we have an opportunity to see what is being built out there that meets the concerns that we've been raising in this particular group and others.
I did also write that I want to make sure that we kind of speak with somebody in DOC, Department of Corrections at the state level, to see what their prison standards, how they kind of change in the years.
Sure.
You know, to see kind of what they look like. And in the hopes that they've, you know, built out newer systems that are a little more conducive to recidivism and rehabilitation. I did have a quick question for you.
Just rest assured, just say my last comment. I'm not just picking on you. I'm doing this with every working group chair to making sure that we are all kind of staying in a line.
Councilman Boylan, I come from a big Italian-Irish family. Being picked on is what I'm used to. Dr. Bell, I do have a quick question. What might the MHOP program benefit from the new facility or in the realm of intake?
What would be nice is to maybe not build quite a big as jail and have a whole, like how Miami's doing, having a separate mental health step-down unit focused on treatment and diversion. So if we're talking big picture.
Well, I mean, certainly, that's what these are supposed to be for.
It's a wish list.
So when you say a unit, I mean, we are still talking about building a new facility potentially. Talk me through how that looks.
Well, somewhere that might be, I guess so, maybe a sort of an example might be how the Matrix House is, but making it more treatment-focused and more, it's, what they're doing in Miami is they're building this facility that has part of it's a crisis stabilization unit, part of it's transitional housing, part of it's substance, like it's this wonderful thing that includes everything. Mm-hmm. And I think the best way to experience it is to really go see it. I know we went down as a group and saw it, and it was amazing.
And I do want to verify, who is building? I mean, is it there?
Well, they already have the building that they're refurbing. I don't know how their funding is working, but it should be open soon.
They took a former state hospital, forensic hospital, that was not being used and completely redid it.
So there's some areas that would be, you know, locked and secured, and then there's some areas that, you know, are not. I think having an option that isn't jail for people with severe mental illness would be good. And I'm not exactly sure how that looks, and I think our community would need to weigh in, too, about what they would want. But I think that a lot of what they're doing in Miami has been groundbreaking, and I think there's a lot to learn.
Please. I was talking with Melissa Nelson. She indicated that I think that Nashville, their new jail, has a similar scope there. Are you familiar with that?
No, I'm not, but I'll have to look that up.
I'll check with her. It was just a passing comment she made to see what they've done up there.
I believe Atlanta is also on the cusp of building that kind of facility, right?
Sorry?
Atlanta is also in the process of building a facility that focuses a lot more on cutting down on the number of jail cells per se in lieu of those kind of facilities.
Also in South Florida, Sheriff Lima helped start this program called SCORE. It's an acronym, but it's to address substance use. So when a police officer brings someone there, it's like a treatment facility. The corrections officers are in scrubs. And he made a presentation at the drug court conference, and I believe that he was saying part of it was funded through like a health insurance provider. And they, even though it's like a correctional facility, they don't have a big name on the front that says jail. And so the focus is on drug treatment intervention.
Now, these are incredibly important as we look to potentially build a new facility or many facilities, which is another thing that I'm probably going to bring to the main board, is, you know, maybe we don't just have one big thing. Maybe we have a couple. That's pretty fascinating to me. I'm glad to see that other people are doing it. I'd love to see if we can get folks, whether it be from Nashville, Atlanta, or clearly we've got HDR here, and we can speak with them. Please, you know, talk with us after this, and we'll make sure that you're on the docket moving forward. Is there any other... Are there any comments amongst the group up here before we go to public comment? All right, we have one public commenter. Carnell Oliver, please come up.
Yes, it's not on. My name is Colonel Oliver. Address is on file. Look, I'm looking at through the numbers. I'm taking this whole issue with the criminal justice system very seriously, because you got 75% of the people that have been impacted by mental health that are black. And to me, that's because it's coming from, the issue comes from Congress, the issue comes from the state, the issue comes from the local level. Everybody has not been doing their job like they're supposed to. The drugs, the sentencing, all of these processes that have been put in place for a long time has been for job security for somebody else. And for me, I've been over to Shawsbach. I stayed there before. You know, I talked to one of the counselors and whatnot. They tried to tell me about a program. And the thing about it is that we need to quit trying to reprogram people and start accepting responsibility. These conditions are man-made. And to you, my councilman Jim Peluso, I've sent you direct actions of things that actually make sense to me. I'm not the type of person that wants to band-aid the problem. If we're going to take on the problem, it starts local, state, federal level. Everybody's got to start doing their job. Because the thing about it is that I know what an animal really lies. It's the money. Too many people have got comfortable with it. And nobody wants to get hurt. It's time that people start getting hurt. Because you hurt too many people, especially people of color. That's where the division lies in. I want clear-cut results. I don't want no band-aid approach just to keep somebody employed and somebody being exploited in the media. Or they have resentment towards another community. All the blame, when it comes down to the criminal justice system, you know where it's going to go at, the white community. Because you never really took responsibility for the actions of your predecessors. And it's got to start somewhere and someday. You cannot avoid it any longer. You got to quit trying to be self-service and start focusing on serving everybody. This system has gotten completely out of hand. And I'm looking at a lot of foolishness on federal level, state, and local level. I don't care about political parties. But you know there's a problem. And it needs to be fixed.
Thank you, Mr. Oliver. All right. Final comments by anyone before we adjourn? All right. Thank you all so much. We'll see you in 2 weeks. All right. Thank you all.
Nice to meet you.
But yeah, everyone, go over this.
There's a typo. So do I bring it?